Our opening words this morning are by Reverend Victoria Safford. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope. Not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower, nor the stalwart, boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which creak on shrill and angry hinges, nor the cheerful, flimsy garden gate of everything is going to be all right, but a different, sometimes lonely place of truth-telling about your own soul first of all, and its condition. The place of resistance and defiance, from which you see the world both as it is and as it could be, as it will be. The place from which you glimpse not only struggle, but joy in the struggle. And we stand there, beckoning and calling, telling people what we're seeing, and asking people what they see. In the midst of this election, one of the most frustrating bits of information I have come across, you can find in an NPR report of a study done by the University of Michigan. They found that when people are presented with facts that contradict their deeply held opinions, it is more likely that in response, they will cling even more strongly to their opinions than change them. So my cynical side says, what then is the point of fact-checking the debates? Many times our beliefs are part of our identities. They sometimes form our friend groups and our associations. So accepting new information might mean not only changing our minds, but as my husband says sometimes, we've got to all get all new friends now. This is the damage done by the us and them mentality. We talked about the us and them mentality in part two of this sermon series on democracy. And now we're on to part three, which brings me to the other reason that this phenomenon happens of people not being able to accept information that contradicts their beliefs. We do not know what to do, often, with the experience of cognitive dissonance. Just as the world becomes broken down into us and them, truth gets broken down into this or that. So we can be very uncomfortable when we find ourselves in between, in a place of doubt or ambiguity or paradox. So today, in part three, we are talking about the third habit of the heart for healing democracy, holding tension in life-giving ways. We are faced every day in our lives with tensions. There's the tension between life as it is and life as we hope it could be. That's why I'm so frustrated with that study, because I have seen people change their minds. I know it is possible. Education is a big thing for me. My mom and stepdad were teachers. I myself went through a massive intellectual awakening in college. I taught in an urban high school in Boston. I have seen minds open. I've seen people hungry for information and curiosity and wonder and challenge even. I've seen it happen. And so how do I live with this hope, this deep experience of possibility, at the same time as obviously there is much over which to despair? Parker Palmer, who wrote the book that inspired this sermon series, calls this in-between path living in the tragic gap. It's the gap between reality and possibility, between despair and blind hope, between confusion and clarity. In the tragic gap, we faithfully hold two things we know are both true, but are in tension. One tragic gap for me is being a working mom. I know it's important to spend a lot of time with my daughter, and I want to. And I know that I want to be a minister. Some days, I feel like I fail at both. Other days, I know that being a parent makes me a better minister, and being a minister makes me a better parent. I am called to hold these two in tension and continue to act. So what tensions do you hold? There's the tension of grief, of moving through the world without someone you love, knowing they are gone, but your grief is still there, your love is still there. We all know there's the tension of relationships, of people you love who have needs or traits that conflict with your own, gosh darn it, and you know you will never be fully resolved, and yet you find a way to go on together. Love helps us hold these tensions. Love and faith. Likewise, despite how divided we seem to be in our democracy, what helps us remain engaged is love and faith. The Christian minister William Sloan Coffin said, "There are three kinds of patriots, two bad, one good. The bad ones are the uncritical lovers and the loveless critics. Good patriots carry on a lover's quarrel with their country, a reflection of God's lover's quarrel with all the world. A lover's quarrel with our country. It's okay if you're not crazy about the word country. What we're talking about here is our home, our fellow people, our way of life. The thing is, our democracy, if you look at it, was intended to generate the creative energy produced by good tension. Look at our separation of powers, our checks and balances, our oppositional systems of justice. The founders knew we will never all agree on everything. I know that even within this congregation, we have very, very different viewpoints sometimes on important questions. And this congregation, I know, was founded before we were even in this building. We were over on A Street, and even before that, because people loved to come together and discuss different ideas with people who didn't necessarily agree with them, but did agree on the goal. That through conversation, we get to a place we couldn't have arrived talking only with those like ourselves. As Parker Palmer says, democracy is taking that tension of our differences and using it as an engine to keep moving forward. But man, the tension of our differences, that doesn't sound like a very fun place to live in. And Parker Palmer knows that. That's why he calls it the tragic gap, also not a rosy picture. Because it's difficult, instead of standing in the middle, holding that tension, we often fall one way or the other into what he calls corrosive cynicism or into irrelevant idealism. Both just take us right out of the action. But tension is a sign of life, in fact. And the end of tension is a sign of death. The final solution was the name given by the Nazis to what we know as the Holocaust. When Hitler took power, the Germans were in a vulnerable place, weakened by war, economic crisis, and multiple social issues. Probably not unlike the place we are in right now, post 9/11. With fear of terrorism, immigration, race relations, and war-torn refugees. People studying our current election have found what they are calling a rise in authoritarianism. In response to massive social change and external threats, some people respond by gravitating toward authoritarianism, which consists of artificial clarity, strongman leaders, traditional values, and a scorn for outsiders. This is what happened in Germany. This is what happens when we cannot cope with cognitive dissonance, when we cannot deal with difference, when we see tension as too stressful. And it's not just all those people out there, it's us too. Perhaps in smaller ways, but us too. But in fact, tension gets a bad rap. Psychologists distinguish between distress, which is negative and destructive tension, and eustress, which is positive and an impetus for growth. We are all, in fact, quite familiar with four sources of eustress: good art, good education, good democracy, and good religion are just four of the things that help us hold positive tension. Good art helps us jump into paradigms that language cannot access. Good education. Take science, that realm that we think is about one truth. And yet good scientists know that every new truth is likely to be followed by another new truth that may contradict the previous. Good religion, invites us into stories and rituals, parables and community that embrace ambiguity and enlarge our imaginations to live meaningfully and faithfully, even amidst questions and suffering. In fact, look at our own Unitarian Universalist seven principles. Many of them seek to hold together tensions. Our third principle, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth. Our fourth principle, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Free and responsible. And our fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. So we all have a right to our own conscience, what we believe. And we also believe that we must participate in the democratic process with others, which isn't just about voting our right of conscience, but getting into conversations open to the idea that we might change our own minds. I'll close with a story that gets at that tension in our fifth principle. John Woolman was a Quaker in the 1700s who was torn by the contradiction he saw between the Quaker belief in human equality and the fact that many Quaker gentry owned slaves. He refused to make that tension disappear by ignoring it, by rationalizing it, or through violence or just giving up. Instead, he brought the tension before his Quaker community and asked them to consider it and to free their slaves. Now, Quakers make decisions by consensus instead of majority rule, and his local group was unable to come to a consensus. But they chose to continue to hold the tension and act within it by supporting Woolman as he pursued his concern. For the next 20 years, Woolman traveled up and down the East Coast, visiting with fellow Quakers in their homes and meeting houses. He did not convince many right away. Remember, this was before the Revolutionary War. But he held to his beliefs. He wore undyed clothing because dye was a product of slave labor. He refused to eat sugar. As a guest, he would fast rather than eat food prepared by slaves, or he would pay them for their work. If he learned he had unintentionally benefited from a slave's work, he would find an anonymous way to pay them. He held this tension for decades, and he did it out of his deep religious practice. In his journal, he wrote, "Before I was 7 years old, I began to be acquainted with the operations of divine love." And he spoke from this love. People listened to him because he spoke not to shame others, but out of love. His concern was not only for the slaves, but also for the slaveholders, whose hearts he believed were being diminished by enslaving fellow humans. Then, after decades of this work, Quakers became the first community in America to free their slaves. Some 80 years before the Civil War. 80 years is a lifetime. In 1783, Quakers petitioned Congress to correct complicated evils and unrighteous commerce created by slavery. And Quakers played a key role in developing the Underground Railroad. So this story is in part a story about next week's sermon, the fourth habit of the heart, personal voice and agency. Woolman stood by his personal voice and agency. But it's also about this third habit of the heart, holding tensions in life-giving ways. Woolman held his own tension about belonging to a community that didn't practice Christian love the way he understood it. And the Quakers held their own tension about keeping among them someone who was really challenging them. Neither Woolman nor the community chose to resolve the tension prematurely by taking a quick vote or banishing Woolman or appeasing him with a happy but meaningless outcome. They kept at it, trusting tension to do its work, with faith that they would find a way through together, embedded in a religious practice that valued that of God in everyone. They kept at it until, as Parker Palmer says, they arrived at a decision of historic proportions. Woolman's story also shows us that sometimes in holding the tension, we create the tension so that we call our communities into honesty. We come together to church to cultivate the patience, the wisdom, the faith that allows us to live in the tragic gap, to hold the tensions in our own lives and in our democracy with our fellow humans. Parker Palmer says, "The democratic experiment is endless unless we blow up the lab. And the explosives to do the job are found within us. But so also is the heart's alchemy that can turn suffering into community, conflict into the energy of creativity, and tension into an opening toward the common good." May it be so.